Welcome to Rapid Clinical Case Review, as our faculty provides perspectives on actual cases of metastatic urothelial bladder cancer. This is Issue 2. I'm medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, Dr. Catherine Fahey from the Lindberger Comprehensive Cancer Center in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Dr. Fern Anari from the Fox Chase Cancer Center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, present real cases from their practices of metastatic urothelial bladder cancer. Following these presentations, Dr. Matt Galsky from the Tisch Cancer Institute in New York City will provide commentary. To begin, the first case is presented by Dr. Anari. So how about your 61-year-old man who received dose-dense MVAC neoadjuvantly, but shortly after surgery presented with metastatic disease?
He started treatment with enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab. He received standard dose treatment once every 3 weeks. Cycle one was complicated by a rash and pruritus that improved with over-the-counter hydrocortisone cream and hydroxyzine as needed. He could feel this right inguinal lymph node, and when he came back for cycle two, was already able to tell me that it felt smaller in size. After cycle two, this rash also did not recur. When he came back with subsequent treatments, he started to have more symptoms such as GI upset, acid reflux, nausea, vomiting. So we were able to adjust his antiemetic regimen to make that more manageable for him. After his fourth cycle, he had a CT scan that showed that the previously enlarged right inguinal lymph node was now sub-centimeter in size. He started to develop intermittent neuropathy in his hands. It didn't affect his fine motor movements, but after this cycle, cycle seven, we opted to drop the day eight of treatment. His neuropathy then remained stable. He had a hospitalization after cycle eight that was related to AKI in the setting of dehydration. During that hospitalization, his TSH was found to be 36, so he was initiated on levothyroxine. He then continued on treatment, which was enfortumab, vedotin, and pembrolizumab. With no day eight treatment, his CAT scans continued to show no evidence of disease. So after cycle 12, we opted to stop the enfortumab vedotin altogether due to excellent treatment response and to mitigate some of the side effects he was having, such as fatigue, GI upset, and neuropathy. He ultimately was switched to an every 6 week dosing of the pembrolizumab to make his schedule more manageable. And his CT scans ever since have shown no evidence of disease. How do you manage these adverse effects associated with enfortumab vedotin, notably rash and neuropathy? And another question particular to this case is, how long do you plan to continue treatment in the setting of complete response?
This is a patient with metastatic urothelial cancer to lymph nodes, treated with first-line enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab. That's really based on the EV-302 study demonstrating that EV plus Pembro is superior to platinum-based chemotherapy, leading to an improvement in overall survival. This patient has a major response to treatment that is thankfully not unusual with EV Pembro. We see response rates based on the EV-302 study of 67% with complete radiographic response rates of 30%. So consistent with what we're seeing here. Also consistent with other therapies in urothelial cancer, the likelihood of response seems to be higher in patients with lymph node-only metastatic disease. That said, when subset analyses or exploratory subgroup analyses were done in EV-302, you see responses across all sites of metastatic disease, including patients with liver metastases, but higher likelihood of response with lymph node-only metastatic disease. This patient has developed side effects related to EV, which are fairly typical. Rash, neuropathy, these are things that we see. Rash tends to be manageable with topical steroids mostly. Sometimes other interventions are needed, but topical steroids mostly. And neuropathy mostly managed with dose holds and dose reductions and oftentimes requiring stopping EV. Stopping EV and continuing immune checkpoint blockade alone, pembrolizumab alone, not an unusual strategy if there are EV-related toxicities that start to be prohibitive. If a patient receives frontline EV Pembro and subsequently develops disease progression, the next steps in terms of treatment are evolving. The default standard is platinum-based chemotherapy, but that's recognizing that we have no randomized data for platinum-based chemotherapy in the second-line setting after EV Pembro. It's just the track record of platinum-based chemotherapy has pushed that now to the second line. However, we always look to see whether or not there are potential biomarkers that might inform particular treatment strategies. And the two biomarkers that are most important in metastatic urothelial cancer that are quote-unquote actionable are mutations in FGFR3 and HER2 expression by immunohistochemistry. Currently, trastuzumab deruxtecan is used in a tumor-agnostic fashion, of course, in patients who have IHC3+ disease. And so IHC3+ HER2 expression in a patient who has received frontline EV Pembro and progresses, whether or not you move to that versus platinum-based chemotherapy, we really don't have data to direct that treatment decision. I think either approach is certainly rational.
So one final question about EV Pembro. Recently, I got kind of a surprise I wasn't expecting on a webinar we were doing on small cell lung cancer. And the docs, the lung docs, were showing me that, you know, we've had IO plus chemo there first line. You know, you see some benefit. It doesn't look too spectacular. But what they pointed out is that for the first time now, they're seeing 10, 12% of people alive and well at 5 years, which they never saw with, conventional chemotherapy. You were just alluding to that in a way. I'm curious, what kind of tail on the curve does it look like? Does it look like there's a tail on the curve with EV Pembro, and how big is it?
So it definitely looks like there's a tail on the curve with EV Pembro. There was some really nice long-term follow-up data presented from the first two studies that included EV Pembro recently. And in patients who achieve a response, their likelihood of staying in a response 2-3 years later is really quite high, and certainly different than the durability of responses that we saw with platinum-based chemotherapy in the past.
The next case is presented by Dr. Fahey. So let's hear about your 78-year-old man with disease progression after first and second-line treatment of metastatic disease.
He had next-generation sequencing done, and this showed an FGFR3 mutation. So after the progression on the enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab and carboplatin and gemcitabine, he was started on third-line erdafitinib. So a question that I have for the panel is, when you think about sequencing these medications for patients who have an FGFR3, are you considering chemotherapy before targeted therapy, or do you prefer to start with targeted therapy and save chemotherapy for progression on a targeted medication? So for this patient, because of his many issues tolerating both of the medication regimens he's received before, he was started on 8 milligrams of erdafitinib. And then once he demonstrated tolerance, he was increased to the 9-milligram dose. And he did have a partial response on that 9-milligram dose. He did develop side effects, including a very painful hand-foot syndrome. So the therapy was held until this resolved, and he restarted at the 6-milligram dose. The hand-foot syndrome, again, did recur. So the dose was held, and he was reduced down to 4 milligrams, which he did tolerate the 4 milligram dose relatively well. There was some foot pain, but the blistering rash seen with hand-foot syndrome didn't appear. Scans after he'd been on treatment for about 6 months did show some minimal growth, and therapy was continued, but ultimately the next set of follow-up scans showed progression of disease in the lungs. At this point, he stopped erdafitinib after he'd received a total of 11 months of treatment. So a question I have for the panel is, when you're giving erdafitinib, how often are you having to do dose reductions to manage to keep patients on therapy? And how long of a response do you tend to see with this medication? How tolerable of a medication do you tend to think of erdafitinib as? Is this a medicine that you feel most patients can get on and stay on, or are you often having to do dose holds and dose reductions to keep people on this medication? With erdafitinib, we know that there are issues with electrolytes. How frequently are you monitoring labs for these patients, and how often are you having to do electrolyte management as part of your management of this medication? With erdafitinib, people can develop problems with high phosphate levels. What guidance do you give your patients in terms of their management of their phosphate? Are there particular dietary recommendations that you can give to people to help them prevent developing high phosphate? And are there particular things that patients on erdafitinib should avoid to try to prevent this complication? In terms of additional medications, are there any additional supportive care meds that you consider to help manage the high phosphate that you can see with the treatment with erdafitinib?
Erdafitinib is approved for patients with metastatic urothelial cancer whose tumors harbor FGFR3 alterations. There are a number of SNVs in FGFR3 that are quote-unquote hotspots. The S249C mutation is the most common, but there are others. These are activating mutations resulting in activation of this receptor tyrosine kinase. So like other oncogenic kinases in oncology, that can be targeted with a small molecule. The other point about genomic sequencing is that there are some FGFR3 fusions as well. And of course, those can potentially be missed depending on the panel that one uses to do sequencing. So one should look out for those as well. The most common is FGFR3 TAC3, and those fusions are associated with response to erdafitinib as well. The response rate to erdafitinib in patients who had received prior platinum-based chemotherapy and immune checkpoint blockade, which really represents the older standard treatment in metastatic urothelial cancer, the monotherapy response rate is about 40%, so it is an active monotherapy. The side effects of erdafitinib that one has to keep in mind, because there's really a class effect. There's a class of side effects related to FGFR inhibition, and we're seeing these side effects with other drugs that are emerging in this category. The side effects that one thinks about are skin and nail toxicities, hyperphosphatemia, and then potentially ophthalmologic toxicities. There are others as well, but those are the side effects that one doesn't encounter so commonly with some of the other drugs we use that you need to think about. Skin and nail toxicity, so there can be onycholysis, patients can lose their nails. There can be hand-foot syndrome, which, as described in this case, can be quite painful, blistering, callousing of the fingers and toes, or the bottom of the plantar aspects of the feet, causing difficulty walking. Those are managed with supportive management, use of moisturizers, thick urea-based moisturizers, and dose holds and dose reductions. The side effects related to elevation in phosphate levels tends to be something that we monitor and requires attention, but patients tend not to experience, of course, signs or symptoms related to that. There's good instructions regarding management of hyperphosphatemia related to erdafitinib in the package insert, but in general, one wants to advise patients to follow a low-fos diet, so that involves restricting foods that dairy, processed meats, whole grains, nuts. Those are potential foods that are high in phosphorus. There can be phosphorus-based additives as well, so we tell our patients to look out for that in their diet. Trying to reduce dietary phosphate, monitoring phosphorus levels, and so usually we get labs about 2 weeks after starting treatment and then monthly from there. For FOS levels less than 7, we continue treatment without change. For FOS levels greater than 7, that's when we start to add phosphate binders. And then, of course, for phosphorus levels higher than that, there are dose hold and dose reduction recommendations.
I'm trying to remember, is it retinal issues that you see with erdafitinib? And like for practical purposes, I mean, do you send them to the ophthalmologist preemptively, or what do you look for?
So we send patients for a baseline ophthalmologic exam. That was how it was done in the trials, recognizing that the feasibility of doing that can differ in different practice settings, but that's our practice. Patients can develop central serous retinopathy, and so having that baseline look in the eyes can be important in terms of being able to detect any changes. What patients report when they run into issues with erdafitinib-related ophthalmologic toxicity is blurred vision. And so anyone with blurred vision, we tell to hold treatment, and then we get them back in with the ophthalmologist. Tends to be quite rapidly reversible and tends to also be pretty responsive to dose reductions. So the development of central serous retinopathy on erdafitinib does not necessitate stopping treatment, but it does necessitate holding treatment and dose reducing.
The next case is presented by Dr. Fahey. Any questions for the faculty about your very fit 72-year-old man presenting with metastatic disease who received EV Pembro?
He has the presence of variant histology with these lipid-rich features. So for patients with variant histology, how does this affect your choice of frontline treatment? In terms of how he did, he tolerated cycle one well, and then in cycle two, he came in with a diffuse macular papular rash. This was managed by doing a dose reduction. When he came in for cycle three, we went from the standard 1.25 milligrams per kilogram down to 1 milligram per kilogram. He tolerated cycle three and cycle four at this new lower dose, but did report a mild sensory neuropathy. When he came in for cycle five, he came in with a diffuse erythematous rash affecting the majority of his body surface area. So at that visit, we held both enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab. He was started on a 0.5 milligrams per kilogram dose of prednisone and referred to dermatology. So a question I have for the faculty, and one of the big challenges with these medications is they do have overlapping toxicities. So when people come in with a toxicity that could be attributable to either medication, how are you handling holding one medication versus the other, evaluating with which medication you think may have caused the toxicity? In his particular case, I suspect the initial rash was from the enfortumab vedotin, and the later rash was likely from the pembrolizumab. And you can see this where both of them can cause toxicities at different time points. To the faculty, the question I would ask is, how do you approach giving steroids versus not in terms of concern for steroids altering efficacy of the pembrolizumab? And do you find that development of toxicity corresponds to response in any of your cases?
This is an individual with metastatic urothelial cancer. His tumor has variant histology. Variant histology is detected with increasing frequency as pathologists look for it more. It's not uncommon to see a minor component of variant histology depending on how hard the pathologist looks and depending on their training in GU pathology. How much that matters in terms of response to treatment is hard to know for sure. Patients enrolled on the studies were required to have a major component of urothelial cancer. Minor components of variant histology were generally allowed. For a drug with like EV that requires the presence of a target to bind to, one could think that heterogeneity in the population of cancer cells that make up a tumor could contribute to heterogeneity and expression of that target. That said, we also know that with antibody drug conjugates, there's some bystander effect. And so the degree to which that matters entirely, we don't know for sure. While there's a lot of debate about should we use a percent cutoff in terms of the percent of variant histology to influence treatment decisions, certainly I feel more comfortable when it's a minor component, especially when using an antibody drug conjugate, which might have a bystander effect. The data regarding EV specifically in variant histologies is limited. There is a prospective study enrolling patients with variant histologies to answer that question. There have been studies looking at Nectin-4 expression in collections of tumors showing variant histology, including those showing pure variant histology. And depending on the variant, you see varying degrees of Nectin-4 expression. But it looks like most of our more commonly encountered minor variants do express Nectin-4. I was going to make a point about the rash with this patient because the question comes up when we use combination therapy about attribution of toxicity because, of course, that's important regarding management. It's important in terms of knowing what to do with the therapeutic regimen. And for enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab, there are certainly lots of side effects that are non-overlapping, and so that's easier to sort out. And then there are some that are overlapping, like rash, that can be quite difficult to sort out. The timing of the rash, the appearance to an experienced dermatologist who focuses on immune-related cutaneous side effects from oncologic agents, recognizing those sorts of specialty-based dermatologists are not readily available. But those who see a lot of rash from anti-cancer therapies oftentimes have a sense for which drug might be causing it, but in reality, very difficult to sort out. Even when we do biopsies, it's hard to sort out. So the general approach to this is the approach that was taken, which is oftentimes we'll stop both drugs initially, initiate supportive care, wait for the rash to improve to grade one, and then reintroduce one drug at a time. And I'll usually reintroduce the drug that I'm least suspicious caused the rash first. If it doesn't recur on that drug, then I'm more comfortable that it was related to the other therapy. And then oftentimes reintroduce the other therapy if the rash can be adequately controlled. The management of rash here involves steroids, and the question comes up, are you comfortable giving steroids, and does that impact response to immune checkpoint blockade? Of course, the bulk of data suggests that if you need steroids to treat an immune-related side effect, then that probably doesn't mitigate the benefit from immune checkpoint blockade. That said, when you're using a combination therapy, you might be treating an EV-related rash with steroids while someone's getting immune checkpoint blockade. And whether or not that's the right approach, of course, we don't know the answer for sure. While based on somewhat limited data and mostly anecdotal data, there is an increasing use of anti-IL-4 for EV-related rash. That's dupilumab. And dupilumab in the context of rash related to EV and rash related to EV pembro does seem to decrease the risk of rash and decrease the risk of rash getting worse and actually improve rash as well. So that is a strategy that can be considered, that steroid sparing in select patients if that strategy is feasible based on where you practice.
Wow, that is really interesting. When you think about dermatologic issues of single agent IO, because I hear that it's not uncommon to see, you know, dermatologic issues, but usually not very much. But what do you typically see?
It can really, you know, like EV, it can, the full spectrum can be seen. So oftentimes it's just pruritus, dry skin, sometimes it's maculopapular. Things like bullous pemphigoid, of course, we think about autoimmune and think about that being a little bit more related. But I can tell you, and there's a little bit of literature around this, that with EV pembro, we are seeing a little bit of bullous pemphigoid happening later than I think one might expect with either agent alone. And so maybe there's something about that combination. With an increasing frequency with an increased prevalence than one would expect with either drug alone. Maybe there's something about the combination related to that.
What about patients with prior benign dermatologic problems, psoriasis, et cetera? Do you pause or think about dose reduction, or any of these dermatologic conditions get you to think twice about EV pembro or even enfortumab alone?
So the only derm comorbidities that I would really be more concerned about would be those that have an autoimmune basis. So if someone has baseline bullous pemphigoid, whether or not starting immune checkpoint blockade is the right thing to do, I think that probably warrants discussion with their dermatologist, depending on whether or not it needs active treatment or not.
So something like psoriasis, even though if it were extensive, it still would be okay?
Yeah, I think psoriasis in the context of metastatic urothelial cancer, there's probably a reasonable risk versus benefit for starting EV pembro, monitoring, and in managing with steroids as necessary.
So another question I sort of flashed on, this comes up with all the ADCs when you were talking about Nectin-4. I'm assuming there's no correlation between Nectin-4 levels and benefit. And any predictors of benefit from either enfortumab or EV pembro that look promising? Again, a lot of the ADCs, TROP2, they say everybody has it, et cetera, et cetera. You guys have been through TROP2 also. Any thoughts about the target levels?
So Nectin-4 expression by immunohistochemistry has been studied in the EV program. There's pretty ubiquitous expression of Nectin-4 on urothelial cancer cells, although the degree of expression, like most proteins, differs from one patient's tumor to another. When that's been looked at and correlated with response to treatment, there's some variable results. There might be some increase in the likelihood of response with higher levels of expression. And there was an FDA analysis of the initial approval of enfortumab vedotin where they looked at the correlation between age score and likelihood of response. And there was some correlation. The problem, and one of the reasons why it's not part of the treatment algorithm in terms of testing, is because even patients with no expression had responses, including complete responses. So the likelihood of response might be higher, but the absence of expression does not preclude a response, and that makes the biomarker more difficult to use in clinical practice. When this was looked at in the EV-302 study, there was no correlation between expression level and benefit, degree of benefit from EV pembro versus platinum-based chemotherapy. So even if you had lower Nectin-4 expression, you still did better with EV pembro than with platinum-based chemotherapy. In terms of other ways to measure Nectin-4, so there is data from Germany suggesting that Nectin-4 amplifications, which are not so uncommon in urothelial cancer, are associated with particular benefit from EV. That data is currently being validated by, or in the process of being validated by, multiple groups to really see if that holds before that becomes part of standard treatment algorithms.
So one final question in terms of future uses of EV pembro. I'm curious whether or not there are any very high-risk situations where you'd even want to use it off-study as adjuvant therapy. Also, any trials looking at adding things onto EV pembro, or any new trial strategies you want to comment on?
So EV pembro has moved earlier into the perioperative setting for muscle-invasive bladder cancer. Those studies have involved giving a neoadjuvant portion of treatment and an adjuvant portion of treatment. The question comes up in patients who didn't get the neoadjuvant portion, should we extrapolate that data to the adjuvant setting? There's really not large randomized studies in the adjuvant setting, purely in the adjuvant setting, that have been initiated. So we're left with really extrapolating from the perioperative studies. And I suspect that will be done in clinical practice, but it's really without any data. And there's no studies that are ongoing right now that will answer that question definitively. From the standpoint of other treatment scenarios, so we know from KEYNOTE-905, the path CR rate with neoadjuvant EV pembro is 57%. That's a really high path CR rate. So that really brings up the question of whether or not we can use this strategy initially and then think of ways to spare bladders in patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer. And there's a whole generation of studies seeking to do that. In terms of building on EV pembro, there have been really three categories of attempts so far. One category of attempts has been including other immune checkpoint inhibitors, and there have been some phase 1b studies with various immune checkpoint inhibitors added to EV pembro. Those are in early stages. The second approach has been to add other antibody drug conjugates. And really the first study to do this is a study from Dana-Farber, which combined enfortumab vedotin, sacituzumab, govotecan initially, and then with pembro as well. And then there's some other programs with newer generation ADCs that are seeking to establish the safety of those triplets in early phase studies. We haven't seen a lot of data from some of the newer ADC triplets. The last category of combinations that's in active development, there was a very small cohort presented at ESMO combining EV pembro with an FGFR3 inhibitor in patients with FGFR3 alterations. Of course, we're awaiting additional data from that approach.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Rapid Clinical Case Review.